The Worldly Philosophers by Robert L. Heilbronner. Continued.
Disc 8.
For in the early 1800s, by and large, those who saved were the very same people as those who put savings to use. In the hard-pressed world of Ricardo or Mill, virtually the only people who could afford to save were wealthy landlords and capitalists, and any sums they put together were usually employed in productive investments of one kind or another. Hence, saving was rightly called accumulation, for it represented a two-sided coin. On the one hand, the amassing of a sum of money, and on the other hand, its immediate employment in purchasing the tools or buildings or land to make still more money. Toward the middle of the 19th century, the structure of the economy changed. The distribution of wealth improved, and along with it, the possibility of saving became open to more and more members of society. And at the same time, business became larger and more institutionalized. Increasingly, it looked for new capital, not just in the pockets of its individual manager owners, but also in the anonymous pocketbooks of savers all over the country. Hence, saving and investing became divorced from one another. They became separate operations carried out by separate groups of people. And this did introduce trouble into the economy. Malthus was right after all, although for reasons he had never foreseen. The trouble is so important, so central to the problem of depression, that we must take a moment to make it clear. We must start out by understanding how we measure the prosperity of a nation. It is not by its gold. Poverty-stricken India is rich in gold. Nor is it by its physical assets. Buildings, mines, factories, and forests did not evaporate in 1932. Prosperity and depression are not so much matters of past glories, but of present accomplishments. Therefore, they are measured by the incomes that we earn. When most of us individually, and therefore all of us collectively, enjoy high incomes, the nation is well off. When our total individual or national income drops, we are in depression. But income, national income, is not a static concept. Indeed, the central characteristic of an economy is the flow of incomes from hand to hand. With every purchase that we make, we transfer a part of our incomes into someone else's pocket. Similarly, every penny of our own incomes, be it wages, salaries, rents, profits, or interest, ultimately derives from money that someone else has spent. Consider any portion of the income that you enjoy, and it will be clear that it has originated from someone else's pocket. When he or she engaged your services, or patronized your store, or bought the output of the corporation in which you own bonds or stock. It is by this process of handing money around, taking in each other's wash, it has been described, that the economy is constantly revitalized. Now, to a large extent, this process of handing income around takes place quite naturally and without hindrance. All of us spend the bulk of our incomes on goods for our own use and enjoyment, on consumption goods, so-called, and since we go on buying consumption goods with fairly consistent regularity, the handing around of a large portion of our national income is assured. The fact that we must eat and clothe ourselves and that we crave enjoyment ensures a regular and steady spending on the part of all of us. So far, everything is quite simple and direct. But there is one portion of our incomes which does not go directly out onto the marketplace to become another's income. That is the money we save. If we tucked these savings into mattresses or hoarded them in cash, we should obviously break the circular flow of income. For then we should be returning to society less than it gave to us. If such a freezing process were widespread and continued, there would soon be a cumulative fall in everybody's money income, as less and less was handed around at each turn. We should be suffering from a depression. But this dangerous break in the income flow does not normally take place, for we do not freeze our savings. We put them into stocks or bonds or banks, and in this way make it possible for them to be used again. Thus, if we buy new stock, we give our savings directly to business. If we put our savings in a bank, they can be used on loan by businessmen who seek capital. Whether we bank our savings or use them to buy insurance or securities, the channels exist for those savings to go back into circulation via the activities of business. For when our savings are taken and spent by business, they again turn up as someone's wages, someone's salary, or someone's profit. But, and notice this vital fact, there is nothing automatic about this savings investment channel. Business does not need savings to carry on its everyday operations. It pays its expenses from the proceeds of its sales. Business needs savings only if it is expanding its operation, for its regular receipts will not usually provide it with enough capital to build a new factory or to add substantially to its equipment. And here is where the trouble enters. A thrifty community will always attempt to save some part of its income, but business is not always in a position to expand its operations. When the business outlook is poor, whether because of gluts in particular markets, or because the international situation is alarming, or because businessmen are nervous about inflation, or for any other reason, the impetus to invest will wane. Why should businessmen expand their facilities when they look to the future with trepidation? And therein lies the possibility of depression. If our savings do not become invested by expanding business firms, our incomes must decline. We should be in the same spiral of contraction as if we had frozen our savings by hoarding them. Can such an eventuality come to pass? We shall see. But note, meanwhile, that this is a strange and passionless tug of war. Here are no greedy landlords, no avaricious capitalists. There are only perfectly virtuous citizens prudently attempting to save some of their incomes, and perfectly virtuous businessmen who are just as prudently making up their minds whether the business situation warrants taking the risk of buying a new machine or building a new plant. And yet, on the outcome of those two sensible decisions, the fate of the economy hangs. For if the decisions are out of joint, if the businessmen invest less than the community tries to save, for example, then the economy will have to adjust to the crimp of depression. The vital question of boom or slump depends more than on anything else on this. The vulnerability of our fate to the interplay of savings and investment is, in a sense, the price we pay for economic freedom. There is no such problem in Soviet Russia, nor was there such in the Egypt of the pharaohs. For in economies of edict, both savings and investment are determined from above, and a total control over the nation's entire economic life ensures that the nation's savings will be used to finance its pyramids or power plants. But not so in a capitalist world. For there, both the decisions to save and the impetus to invest are left to the free decisions of the economic actors themselves. And because those decisions are free, they can be out of joint. There can be too little investment to absorb our savings, or too little savings to support our investment. Economic freedom is a highly desirable state, but in bust and boom, we must be prepared to face its possible consequences. We have almost lost sight of John Maynard Keynes and the treatise on money. But not quite, for the treatise was a sparkling exposition of this seesaw of savings and investment. The idea was not original with Keynes, for a long list of important economists had already pointed to the critical roles of these two factors in the business cycle. But as with everything that Keynes touched, the bare abstractions of economics took on a new luster in his prose. Thus, it has been usual to think of the accumulated wealth of the world as having been painfully built up out of that voluntary abstinence of individuals from the immediate enjoyment of consumption, which we call thrift. But it should be obvious that mere abstinence is not enough by itself to build cities or drain fens. It is enterprise which builds and improves the world's possessions. If enterprise is afoot, wealth accumulates whatever may be happening to thrift. And if enterprise is asleep, wealth decays whatever thrift may be doing. Yet, for all its masterful analysis, no sooner had Keynes written the treatise than, figuratively, he tore it up. For his theory of a seesaw of savings and investment failed at one central point. It did not explain how an economy could remain in a state of prolonged depression. Indeed, as the very analogy of the seesaw indicates, it seemed as if an economy that was weighted down by surplus savings must, in fairly short order, right itself and swing the other way. For savings and investment, thrift and enterprise, were not utterly unconnected economic activities. On the contrary, they were tied together in the market where businessmen bought savings, or at least borrowed them. The money market. Savings, like any other commodity, had its price, the rate of interest. Therefore, so it seemed, at the bottom of a slump, when there was a flood of savings, its price should decline, exactly as, when there was a glut of shoes, the price of shoes declined. And as the price of savings cheapened, as the rate of interest went down, the incentive to invest appeared very likely to increase. If a new factory was too expensive to build when the money for it would cost 10%, might it not look much more profitable when the money could be had for a payment of only 5%? Hence, the seesaw theory seemed to promise that there would be an automatic safety switch built right into the business cycle itself, that when savings became too abundant, they would become cheaper to borrow, and that thereby business would be encouraged to invest. The economy might contract, said the theory, but it seemed certain to rebound. But this was exactly what failed to happen in the Great Depression. The rate of interest declined, but nothing happened. The old nostrums were trotted out, a pinch of local relief and a large dose of hopeful waiting. And still the patient failed to improve. For all its logic, something was patently missing from the neat formulation of the rate of interest always hovering over the seesaw of savings and investment to keep it in balance. Something else must be holding the economy back. Keynes's master book had been brewing for some time. To understand my state of mind, he had written to George Bernard Shaw in 1935. He had just reread Marx and Engels at Shaw's suggestion and found them little to his liking. You have to know that I believe myself to be writing a book on economic theory, which will largely revolutionize, not, I suppose, at once, but in the course of the next 10 years, the way the world thinks about economic problems. I can't expect you or anyone else to believe this at the present stage, but for myself, I don't merely hope what I say. In my own mind, I'm quite sure. He was, as usual, quite right. The book was to be a bombshell. Yet it is very doubtful whether Shaw would have recognized it as such had he attempted to digest it. It had a forbidding title, The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, and a still more forbidding interior. One can imagine Shaw goggling on page 25 at, Let Z be the aggregate supply price of the output from employing N men, the relationship between Z and N being written Z equals phi times N, which can be called the aggregate supply function. And if this were not enough to frighten off almost anyone, there was a great dearth of that panorama of social action which the layman had come to expect from a perusal of Smith or Mill or Marx. Here and there were wonderful passages. There was a famous one comparing the choosing of stocks and the picking of beauty contest winners. But the passages came as oases between deserts of algebra and abstract analysis. And yet the book was revolutionary. No other word will quite do. It stood economics on its head, very much as the wealth of nations and capital had done. For the general theory had a startling and dismaying conclusion. There was no automatic safety mechanism, after all. Rather than a seesaw that would always right itself, the economy resembled an elevator. It could be going up or down, but it could also be standing perfectly still. And it was just as capable of standing still on the ground floor as at the top of the shaft. A depression, in other words, might not cure itself at all. The economy could lie stagnant indefinitely, like a ship becalmed. But how could this be? Would not the flood of savings at the bottom of the slump push down the rate of interest, and would this not in turn induce business to use cheap money to expand its plant? Keynes found the flaw in this argument in the simplest and most obvious, once it had been pointed out, fact of economic life. There would be no flood of savings at the bottom of the trough. For what happened when an economy went into an economic tailspin was that its income contracted, and what happened as its income contracted was that its savings were squeezed out. How could a community be expected to save as much when everyone was hard up as when everyone was prosperous, asked Keynes. Quite obviously it could not. The result of a depression would not be a glut of savings, but a drying up of savings, not a flood of saving, but a trickle. And so it was, in fact. In 1929, the American private citizenry put aside $3.7 billion out of its income. By 1932 and 1933, it was saving nothing. In fact, it was even drawing down its old savings made in the years before. Corporations, which had tucked away $2.6 billion at the top of the boom after paying out taxes and dividends, found themselves losing nearly $6 billion 3 years later. Quite obviously, Keynes was right. Saving was a kind of luxury that could not withstand hard times. But the larger consequence of this decline in saving was of greater significance than even the loss of individual security that the decline brought about. The larger consequence was that the economy found itself in a condition of paralysis just when it most needed to be dynamic. For if there was no surplus of saving, there would be no pressure on interest rates to encourage businessmen to borrow. And if there were no borrowing and investment spending, there would be no impetus for expansion. The economy would not budge an inch. It would remain in a condition of equilibrium despite the presence of unemployed men and women and underutilized plant and equipment. Thus, the paradox of poverty amidst plenty and the anomaly of idle men and idle machines. At the bottom of a slump, there was a heartless contradiction between a crying need for goods and an insufficiency of production. But the contradiction was purely a moral one, for the economy did not operate to satisfy human wants. Wants are always as large as dreams. It turned out goods to satisfy demand, and demand is as small as a person's pocketbook. Hence, the unemployed were little more than economic zeros. They might as well have been on the moon for all the economic influence they exerted on the marketplace. To be sure, once investment declined and the economy shrank in size, social misery appeared. But not, as Keynes points out, effective social misery. The nation's conscience would not do as an effective substitute for enough investment. Rather, since savings declined along with investment, the economic flow turned over evenly, quite unaffected by the fact that it was smaller than it used to be. A peculiar state of affairs indeed, a tragedy without a villain. No one can blame society for saving when saving is so apparently a private virtue. It is equally impossible to chastise businessmen for not investing when no one would be so happy to comply as they if they saw a reasonable chance for success. The difficulty is no longer a moral one, a question of justice, exploitation, or even human foolishness. It is a technical difficulty, almost a mechanical fault. But its price is no less high for all that, for the price of inactivity is unemployment. And here was the most indigestible fact of all. The willingness to invest could not go on indefinitely. Sooner or later, investment was likely to contract. For at any time, an industry is limited by the size of the market to which it caters. Let us take the example of the railroads in the 1860s. A time of vast investment in new railroad lines. The early railway magnates were not building for the markets of the 1960s. Had they proceeded to lay the trackage the economy would need 100 years later, they would have been building lines to non-existent cities in uninhabited territory. So they built what could be used, and then they stopped. Similarly with the auto industry. Even if Henry Ford had been able to find the capital to build the 1950 River Rouge plant in 1910, he would have gone bankrupt in a hurry. The roads, the gas stations, the demand for that many cars were simply lacking. Or to bring the matter a little closer to the present, American business spent over $300 billion in 1985 to add to its durable equipment. But it did not spend $500 billion, although someday it may have to. In 1985, no one could use that much capacity. And so investment has its typical pattern. At first eagerness to take advantage of a new opportunity, then caution, lest enthusiasm lead to overbuilding, then inactivity when the market has been satisfied for the time being. If, as each separate investment project came to a halt, another immediately appeared, there need never be a slump. But such is not likely to be the case. The mere fact that human wants are vast does not mean that any investment will pay for itself. The economy is littered with the businesses that have died of rash and foolhardy overexpansion. Most investment needs more than the stimulus of sanguine expectations. It needs something more concrete. Some new invention, some better way of doing things, some intriguing product to catch the public eye. And such opportunities, as any businessman will tell you, are not always there. Hence, when one investment project dies, there may not be another ready to step into the breach. If there is, if investment maintains its size, although it changes its composition, the economy will sail smoothly along. But if there is no ready substitute for each investment casualty, contraction will begin. Looking at this intrinsic vulnerability of the system, Keynes wrote, "Ancient Egypt was doubly fortunate and doubtless owed to this its fabled wealth, in that it possessed two activities, namely pyramid building and the search for the precious metals, the fruits of which, since they could not serve the needs of man by being consumed, did not stale with abundance. The Middle Ages built cathedrals and sang dirges. Two pyramids, two masses for the dead, are twice as good as one. But not so, two railways from London to York." Here, then, was the gloomy diagnosis of the general theory. First, an economy in depression could stay there. There was nothing inherent in the economic mechanism to pull it out. One could have equilibrium with unemployment, even massive unemployment. Second, prosperity depended on investment. If business spending for capital equipment fell, a spiral of contraction would begin. Only if business investment rose would a spiral of expansion follow. And third, investment was an undependable drive wheel for the economy. Uncertainty, not assurance, lay at the very core of capitalism. Through no fault of the businessman, it was constantly threatened with satiety, and satiety spelled economic decline. Certainly, it was an unsettling outlook, but it would have been utterly unlike Keynes to content himself with making a diagnosis of gloom and letting it go at that. With all its prophecy of danger, the general theory was never meant to be a book of doom. On the contrary, it held out a promise, and it proposed a cure. As a matter of fact, the cure had begun before its actual prescription was written. The medicine was being applied before the doctors were precisely sure what it was supposed to do. The 100 days of the New Deal had enacted a flood of social legislation that had been backing up for 20 years behind a dam of governmental apathy. These laws were meant to improve the social tone, the morale, of a discontented nation. But it was not social legislation that was designed to revitalize the patient. That tonic was something else. The deliberate undertaking of government spending to stimulate the economy. It began as makeshift work relief. Unemployment had reached the point at which some sort of action was dictated by pure political necessity. After all, this was a time when there were riots in Dearborn and a ragged march on Washington, when families huddled for warmth in municipal incinerator buildings and even scrabbled for food in garbage trucks. Relief was essential and began under Hoover. Then, under Roosevelt, relief turned into leaf-raking, and leaf-raking turned into constructive enterprise. The government was suddenly a major economic investor. Roads, dams, auditoriums, airfields, harbors, and housing projects blossomed forth. Keynes came to Washington in 1934. This was when he made his notes on the impression of President Roosevelt's hands, and urged that the program be extended further. The statistics showed that the bottom had fallen out of private investment activity. Business expansion, which had pumped out $15 billion in wages and salaries and profits in 1929, had fallen to the appalling figure of $886 million in 1932. A drop of 94%. Something had to start up the investment motor that hoisted the economic car up the shaft, and he hoped that government spending would act as such a stimulus by bolstering the nation's general buying power. Priming the pump, it was called in those days. Hence, when the general theory came out in 1936, what it offered was not so much a new and radical program as a defense of a course of action that was already being applied. A defense and an explanation. For the general theory pointed out that the catastrophe facing America, and indeed the whole Western world, was only the consequence of a lack of sufficient investment on the part of business. And so the remedy was perfectly logical. If business was not able to expand, the government must take up the slack. With his tongue only partly in his cheek, Keynes had written, "If the Treasury were to fill old bottles with banknotes, bury them at suitable depths in disused coal mines, which are then filled up to the surface with town rubbish, and leave it to private enterprise on well-tried principles of laissez-faire to dig the notes up again, there need be no more unemployment, and with the help of the repercussions, the real income of the community would probably become a good deal larger than it is. It would indeed be more sensible to build houses and the like, but if there are practical difficulties in the way of doing this, the above would be better than nothing." To some, it no doubt appeared that many of the more unorthodox government projects were no more sane than Keynes's whimsical proposal. But now, at least, they had a rationale behind them. If private enterprise found itself unable to carry forward with a big enough program of investment, then the government must fill in as best it could. The need for stimulation of some sort was so imperative that almost anything was better than nothing. And if investment could not be directly stimulated, why then at least consumption could. While investment was the capricious element in the system, consumption provided the great floor of economic activity. Hence public works projects were thought to attack the problem with the two-edged sword. By directly helping to sustain the buying power of the otherwise unemployed and by leading the way for a resumption of private business expansion. Keynes himself, in a letter to the New York Times in 1934, wrote, "I see the problem of recovery in the following light. How soon will normal business enterprise come to the rescue? On what scale, by which expedients, and for how long is abnormal government expenditure advisable in the meantime?" Note, abnormal. Keynes did not see the government program as a permanent interference with the course of business. He saw it as lending a helping hand to a system that had slipped and was struggling to regain its balance. It seemed the essence of common sense. In fact, it was the essence of common sense, and yet the pump-priming program never brought the results that the planners had hoped for. Total government spending, which had hovered at the $10 billion level from 1929 until 1933, rose to $12 billion, to $13 billion, then to $15 billion by 1936. Private investment picked itself up from the floor and recovered two-thirds of its loss. Private firms invested $10 billion by 1936. The national income and national consumption rose by 50% after 3 years of government injections. And yet unemployment lingered on. It was manageable now, but there were still at least 9 million out of work, hardly the mark of a new economic era. There were two reasons why the cure did not work better. First, the program of government spending was never carried out to the full extent that would have been necessary to bring the economy up to full employment. Later, in the Second World War, government spending rose to the then monumental figure of $103 billion. This brought not only full employment, but inflation. But within the framework of a peacetime economy in the 30s, such all-out spending was quite impossible. Indeed, even a modest program of government expenditure soon brought murmurs that federal power was overstepping its traditional bounds. To make matters worse, the Federal Reserve Board was more afraid of inflation, at the bottom of a depression, than of unemployment, so that policies were established that discouraged bank lending. The second reason was closely allied with the first. Neither Keynes nor the government spenders had taken into account that the beneficiaries of the new medicine might consider it worse than the disease. Government spending was meant as a helping hand for business. It was interpreted by business as a threatening gesture. Nor is this surprising. The New Deal had swept in on a wave of anti-business sentiment. Values and standards that had become virtually sacrosanct were suddenly held up to skeptical scrutiny and criticism. The whole conception of business rights, property rights, and the role of government was rudely shaken. Within a few years, business was asked to forget its traditions of unquestioned preeminence and to adopt a new philosophy of cooperation with labor unions, acceptance of new rules and regulations, reform of many of its practices. Little wonder that it regarded the government in Washington as inimical, biased, and downright radical. And no wonder in such an atmosphere that its eagerness to undertake large-scale investment was dampened by the uneasiness it felt in this unfamiliar climate. Hence, every effort of the government to undertake a program of sufficient magnitude to mop up all the unemployed, probably a program at least twice as large as it did in fact undertake, was assailed as further evidence of socialist design. And at the same time, the halfway measures the government did employ were just enough to frighten business away from undertaking a full-scale effort by itself. It was a situation not unlike that found in medicine. The medicine cured the patient of one illness, only to weaken him with its side effects. Government spending never truly cured the economy, not because it was economically unsound, but because it was ideologically upsetting. It was not meant to be upsetting. It was a policy born of desperation rather than design. Had the government not begun to open the valve of public spending, in all likelihood private business would eventually again have led the way. It always had done so in the past, and despite the severity of the Great Depression, it would in time unquestionably have found new avenues of adventure. But it was impossible to wait. The American people had waited for 4 long years, and they were in no mood to wait much longer. Economists began to speak of stagnation as the chronic condition of capitalism. The voice of Marx rang louder than it ever had rung in the past. Many pointed to the unemployed as prima facie evidence that Marx was right. The mumble of Veblen was discernible in the faddish vogue of the technocrats, who wanted to call out not the proletariat, but the engineers. And there was the still more chilling voice that never wearied of pointing out that Hitler and Mussolini knew what to do with their unemployed. In this welter of remedies and advocacy of desperate action, the message of the general theory, the civilized voice of Keynes was certainly moderate and reassuring. For while Keynes espoused a policy of managing capitalism, he was no opponent of private enterprise. "It is better that a man should tyrannize over his bank balance than over his fellow citizens," he had written in the General Theory. And he went on to state that if the government would only concern itself with providing enough public investment, the working of the vast bulk of the economy could and should be left to private initiative. In review, the General Theory was not a radical solution. It was rather an explanation of why an inescapable remedy should work. If an economy in the doldrums could drift indefinitely, the price of government inaction might be graver by far than the consequences of bold unorthodoxy. The real question was a moral, not an economic one. During the Second World War, Professor Hayek wrote a book, The Road to Serfdom, which for all its exaggerations contained a deeply felt and cogent indictment of the overplanned economy. Keynes sympathized with and liked the book, but while praising it, he wrote to Hayek, "I should conclude rather differently. I should say that what we want is not no planning, or even less planning. Indeed, I should say we almost certainly want more. But the planning should take place in a community in which as many people as possible, both leaders and followers, wholly share your own moral position. Moderate planning will be safe enough if those carrying it out are rightly oriented in their own minds and hearts to the moral issue. This is, in fact, already true of some of them. But the curse is that there is also an important section who could be said to want planning not in order to enjoy its fruits, but because morally they hold ideas exactly the opposite of yours, and wish to serve not God but the devil." Is this perhaps a naive hope? Can capitalism be managed, in the sense that government planners will turn the faucet of spending on and off in such a way as to supplement, but never to displace, private investment? The issue is still with us, still unresolved. But let us not debate it here. We will postpone discussion of it to the coming chapter. For here we are dealing with the man Keynes and his beliefs, however misguided we may judge them to be. And it would be a grave error in judgment to place this man, whose aim was to rescue capitalism, in the camp of those who wanted to submerge it. True, he urged the socialization of investment, although he was never very clear about what that meant. But if he sacrificed the part, it was to save the whole. For at heart he was a conservative, long an admirer of Edmund Burke and of the tradition of limited government for which Burke stood. "How can I accept the communist doctrine," he had written in 1931, when the view was by no means shared by many others, "which sets up as its Bible, above and beyond criticism, an obsolete textbook which I know not only to be scientifically erroneous, but without interest or application to the modern world? How can I adopt a creed which, preferring the mud to the fish, exalts the boorish proletariat above the bourgeoisie and the intelligentsia, who, with all their faults, are the quality of life and surely carry the seeds of all human achievement?" One might quibble with Keynes's theories, with his diagnosis and with his cure, although in justice it must be said that no more thoughtful theory, no profounder diagnosis, and no more convincing cure was propounded by those who insisted that Keynes was only a mischievous meddler with a system that worked well enough. But no one could gainsay his aim. The creation of a capitalist economy in which unemployment, the greatest and gravest threat to its continuance, would be largely eliminated. He was a man incapable of doing only one thing at a time. While he was constructing the general theory in his mind, he was building a theater in Cambridge with his pocketbook. It was a typically Keynesian venture. Starting at a loss, the theater was in the black in 2 years, and its artistic success was immense. Keynes was everywhere at the same time. Financial backer, ticket taker, on one occasion when the clerk failed to materialize, husband of the leading lady, Lydia acted in Shakespeare with extremely good notices, even concessionaire. He attached a restaurant to the theater and jealously watched its receipts, graphing them against different types of entertainment to ascertain how food consumption varied with the state of one's humor. There was a bar, too, where champagne was sold at a specially low discount to promote its wider consumption. It was probably the most pleasant interlude in his pleasant life. But it did not go on for long. In 1937, his success story was cut short. He suffered a heart attack and was forced into idleness. Well, comparative idleness. He continued to do an active trading business, and to edit the Economic Journal, and to write a few brilliant articles in defense of the general theory. One academician had said, upon its appearance, "Einstein has actually done for physics what Mr. Keynes believes himself to have done for economics." And Keynes was not a man to let someone get away with that. When he wanted to, he could wield an acid pen, and he now set to work systematically to demolish his critics, singly and en masse. Sometimes with sarcasm, occasionally with brilliance, and not infrequently with petulance. "Mr. X refuses to understand me," seemed to rise like a sigh of despair from many of his brief communications. But the war was approaching. Munich was followed by worse. Keynes watched in indignation the pusillanimous letters of some left-wingers to the New Statesman and Nation, on whose board he managed to find time to serve. He wrote to its columns, "Surely it is impossible to believe that there can really be such a person as a socialist. I disbelieve in his existence." And then, "When it comes to a showdown, scarce 4 weeks have passed before they remember that they are pacifists and write defeatist letters to your columns, leaving the defense of freedom and civilization to Colonel Blimp and the old school tie, for whom 3 cheers. When the war came, Keynes was too ill to be a permanent member of the government. They gave him a room in the Treasury and picked his brains. He had already written another book, How to Pay for the War, a daring plan that urged deferred savings as the principal means of financing the war. The plan was simple. A portion of every wage earner's pay would automatically be invested in government bonds that would not be available for redemption until after the war. Then, just when the consumer buying would again be needed, the savings certificates could be cashed. Compulsory saving. What a change from his earlier efforts to achieve a kind of compulsory investment. But the change was in the times and not in Keynes's thinking. The old problem had been too little investment, and its symptom had been unemployment. The new problem was too much investment, an all-out armament effort, and its symptom was inflation. But the framework of the general theory was as useful in understanding inflation as it had been in understanding inflation's opposite, unemployment. Only it was upside down. Now more and more incomes were being handed out with each turn of the wheel, instead of less and less. Accordingly, the cure was the opposite of the depression tonic. Then Keynes had urged that investment be bolstered by every possible means. Now he urged that savings must be increased. The point is important because many have mistakenly judged Keynes as an economist who favored inflation. He did favor reflation, a pumping up of incomes and not prices, from the depths of the Depression. But to think that he favored inflation for inflation's sake was to disregard such a passage as this from the Economic Consequences of the Peace. Lenin is said to have declared that the best way to destroy the capitalist system was to debauch the currency. By a continuing process of inflation, governments can confiscate, secretly and unobserved, an important part of the wealth of their citizens. By this method, they not only confiscate, but they confiscate arbitrarily. Lenin was certainly right. There is no subtler, no surer means of overturning the existing basis of society than to debauch the currency. The process engages all the hidden forces of economic law on the side of destruction, and does it in a manner which not one man in a million is able to diagnose. But despite its logic and its appeal, Keynes made much of the fact that his deferred savings plan would serve to widen the distribution of wealth by making everyone an owner of government bonds. The plan failed to arouse much support. It was too new. The old methods of taxation and rationing and voluntary savings drives were tried and true trusty weapons of war finance. A deferred credit scheme was tacked on as an ornamental flourish, but it was never given the central place Keynes had envisioned for it. But he had no time to lament its cool reception. He was now fully embroiled in the British war effort. In 1941, he flew via Lisbon to the United States. It was to be the first of 6 such trips. Lydia went with him as his nurse and guardian. Ever since his first heart attack, she had assumed the role of timekeeper for her indefatigable husband, and many a dignitary had been politely but firmly ushered out at the expiration of his allotted stay. "Time, gentlemen," said Lydia, and business stopped. His trips to the United States involved the precarious problems of Britain's war finance and the overhanging question of what was to happen in the terrible post-war interim. Britain was not the only one concerned. The United States as well wanted to lay the foundation for a flow of international trade that would avoid the desperate financial warfare that had too often led to actual warfare. An international bank and an international monetary fund were to be established to act as guardians of the international flow of money. In place of the old dog-eat-dog world, where each nation sought to undercut everyone else, there would be a new cooperative effort to help out a nation that found itself in monetary difficulties. The final conference was held at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. Keynes, despite his illness and fatigue, clearly dominated the conference. Not when it came to winning all his points, for the final plan was far closer to the American proposals than to the British, but by virtue of his personality. One of the delegates gives us an insight into the man in this entry in his journal. "This evening I participated in a particularly recherché celebration. Today is the 500th anniversary of the concordat between King's College, Cambridge, and New College, Oxford, and to commemorate the occasion, Keynes gave a small banquet in his room." Keynes, who had been looking forward to the event for weeks as excitedly as a schoolboy, was at his most charming. He delivered an exquisite allocution. It was an interesting example of the curiously complex nature of this extraordinary man. So radical an outlook in matters purely intellectual, in matters of culture, he is a true Burkean conservative. It was all very pianissimo, as befitting the occasion, but his emotion when he spoke of our debt to the past was truly moving. When Keynes made his final speech at the conclusion of the conference, "If we can continue in a larger task, as we have begun in this limited task, there is hope for the world," the delegates rose and cheered him. As always, his major efforts did not preclude a few minor ones. He was made a director of the Bank of England. "Which will make an honest woman of the other is anyone's guess," he had declared, and chairman of a new government committee that concerned itself with music and the arts. Thus, while he was carrying the weight of presenting Britain's point of view to an international economic council, he was also keeping up a stream of correspondence on music travelers, the Vic Wells Ballet, poetry reading and library exhibits. And, of course, he kept on collecting. He scooped the Folger Library on a rare volume of Spencer and explained a little guiltily to the librarian that he had used the Foreign Office bag to have the catalog sent over to him. And the honors started to pour in. He was elevated to the peerage. He was now Lord Keynes, Baron of Tilton, an estate he had bought in middle life only to discover to his delight that one of the branches of the Keynes line had once owned these lands. There were honorary degrees to be accepted at Edinburgh, at the Sorbonne, and from his own university. There was an appointment to the Board of Trustees of the National Gallery, and still there was work. The first loan to Britain had to be negotiated, and Keynes, of course, was given the task of presenting Britain's viewpoint. When he returned from that trip, and a reporter asked him if it were true that England was now to be the 49th state, Keynes's reply was succinct: "No such luck." In 1946, the ordeal was over. He went back to Sussex to read and relax and prepare for a resumption of teaching at Cambridge. One morning, there was a fit of coughing. Lydia flew to his side. He was dead. The services were held in Westminster Abbey. His father, John Neville Keynes, aged 93, and his mother, Florence, walked up the aisle. The country mourned the loss of a great leader, gone just at a time when his acumen and wisdom were most needed. Times said in a lengthy obituary on April 22nd, "By his death, the country has lost a great Englishman." He was not an angel by any means. This most sparkling of the great economists was only a human being, albeit a remarkable one, with all the faults and foibles of any person. He could win £22 from two countesses and a duke at bridge and crow delightedly. He could also undertip a bootblack in Algiers and refuse to rectify his error, saying of all things, "I will not be a party to debasing the currency." He could be extraordinarily kind to a slow-thinking student. Economists, he said, should be humble, like dentists. And obnoxiously cutting to a businessman or high official to whom he happened to take an intuitive dislike. Sir Harry Goschen, the chairman of the National Provincial Bank, once rubbed Keynes wrong by urging that, "We let matters take their natural course." Keynes replied, "Is it more appropriate to smile or rage at these artless sentiments? Best of all, perhaps, just to let Sir Harry take his natural course." Keynes himself gave the clue to his own genius. although he was not at the time writing about himself. Discussing his old teacher Alfred Marshall, whom he both loved and rather lovingly derided as an absurd old man, Keynes spelled out the qualifications for an economist. The study of economics does not seem to require any specialized gifts of an unusually high order. Is it not intellectually regarded a very easy subject compared with the higher branches of philosophy or pure science? An easy subject at which very few excel. The paradox finds its explanation, perhaps, in that the master economist must possess a rare combination of gifts. He must be mathematician, historian, statesman, philosopher, in some degree. He must understand symbols and speak in words. He must contemplate the particular in terms of the general and touch abstract and concrete in the same flight of thought. He must study the present in the light of the past for the purposes of the future. No part of man's nature or his institutions must lie entirely outside his regard. He must be purposeful and disinterested in a simultaneous mood, as aloof and incorruptible as an artist, yet sometimes as near the earth as a politician. Marshall, as Keynes says, only approximated that ideal. For Victorian that he was, he lacked the necessary iconoclasm to give his economics deep social penetration. Keynes came closer. The Bloomsbury attitude of nothing sacred spilled over into the sacred precincts of economic orthodoxy. Once again the world was put into focus by a man not so blind as to fail to see its sickness, and not so emotionally and intellectually dispossessed as to wish not to cure it. If he was an economic sophisticate, he was politically devout, and it is in this curious combination of an engineering mind and a hopeful heart that his greatness lies. Chapter 10. The Contradictions of Joseph Schumpeter. In 1930, while most people were occupied with the darkening depression, Keynes was toying with an idea of a very different hue. In disregard of his own dictum, that in the long run we are all dead, he had just taken a glimpse into the future, the long-term future, and he had come up with a prophecy quite in contrast with the contemporary rumblings of stagnation. For what Keynes saw ahead, barring such catastrophes as an uncontrollable flood of population or a totally destructive war, was not a continuation of the current state of misery and doubt, but a prospect so fair as to be almost unbelievable, nothing less than Adam Smith's heralded land of universal plenty. Keynes called his little excursion into the future economic possibilities for our grandchildren, of whom, it might be added, he himself had none. And what were these possibilities? Well, not to wax too lyrical, they hinted at something like a modest millennium. By the year 2030, Keynes thought, the economic problem might be solved, not just the immediate crimp of depression, but the economic problem itself, the age-old fact of not enough to go around. For the first time in history, mankind, British mankind at any rate, would have emerged from a struggle against want into a new milieu in which everybody could with ease be given a generous helping at the communal table. It was a typically Keynesian thrust in an unexpected direction. After the First World War, when the world was basking in a glow of self-congratulation, it was Keynes who had rattled the skeleton in the closet. Now in the 30s, when the world turned to self-commiseration, it was the same Keynes who bravely talked of an impending end to its travail. But he was not merely whistling in the dark. On the contrary, he was only taking up a strand of economics which had absorbed all the master planners of the past, the tendency of capitalism to grow. In times of depression, that tendency was apt to be overlooked. And yet, looking backward over 200 years of capitalism, it was not merely a meaningless succession of exhilarating booms and frustrating busts that characterized the system, but a steady, albeit highly irregular, upward climb. The 40 million Englishmen of Keynes's day most certainly did not consider themselves the benefactors of a bountiful providence, but for all the hardship of the times, they unquestionably enjoyed a far better seat at nature's table than the 10 million Englishmen of Malthus' time. It was not that nature herself had become more generous. On the contrary, as the famous law of diminishing returns made clear, nature yielded up her wealth more grudgingly as she was more intensively cultivated. The secret to economic growth lay in the fact that each generation attacked nature not only with its own energies and resources, but with the heritage of equipment accumulated by its forebears. And as that heritage grew, As each generation added its quota of new knowledge, factories, tools, and techniques to the wealth of the past, human productivity increased with astonishing rapidity. A factory worker in the 1960s in the United States turned out over 5 times as much goods in an hour's toil as a worker at the time of the Civil War. Not because he worked harder or more skillfully, but because he worked with technological powers that made him a superman compared with his Civil War predecessor. And if only this process of steadily enhancing productivity would continue for another century, a mere 3 generations, then capitalism would have done the trick. For another 100 years of amassing wealth, Keynes calculated, at the same pace as the last 100 years, would multiply England's real productive wealth by 7.5 times. By the year 2030, every worker would have at his elbow enough machinery to make him a superman in terms of his grandfather who lived in 1930. And such a vast increase in productiveness could make all the difference. It could relegate economics as a science of scarcity to the history books. The new problem of society would be not how to find leisure, but how to cope with unprecedented quantities of it. With a grin, Keynes quoted the traditional epitaph of the old charwoman. "Don't mourn for me, friends, don't weep for me never, for I'm going to do nothing forever and ever. With psalms and sweet music the heavens'll be ringing, but I shall have nothing to do with the singing." It was, of course, only a theoretical jaunt into the future, and no one took it very seriously. The machinery was clanking too alarmingly in 1930 for anyone to regard such a prospectus as much more than a pleasant fantasy, and Keynes himself soon lost sight of it in the immediate problem of analyzing the nature of the unemployment that was paralyzing the world. But wishful or sober, Keynes's vista is important for us, for with economic possibilities for our grandchildren, we are for the first time confronted with the question of our own futures. Everything we have considered heretofore is, after all, only history. The evolution of the regulated and codified world of the 17th century into the atomistic market capitalism described by Adam Smith, the near escape of that capitalism from the landlord-dominated economy anticipated by Ricardo, or the overpopulated subsistence society feared by Malthus, its presumptive self-destruction forecast by Marx, its chronic depressive tendency dissected by Keynes. All these adventures and misadventures of capitalism, however interesting, nevertheless lacked a certain element of suspense, for we knew at each juncture of history what the outcome would finally be. Now we are placed in a more uncomfortable position. As we turn to the modern economists, we are no longer discussing the ideas that helped shape our past. It is our own society, our own fate, our children's inheritance that lie in the balance. And so we must turn from a study of our past to an appraisal of the future. Where does capitalism stand today? What signposts point to the years ahead? These are the great questions of the modern world to which we must now bend our attention. Thus we move to a worldly philosopher who, perhaps even more than Keynes, speaks to us with a voice that is unmistakably contemporary. The voice belongs to a small, dark, aristocratic man with a taste for pretentious prose and theatrical gestures. When he lectured on the economy at Harvard in the midst of the Depression, Joseph Schumpeter would stride into the lecture hall and, divesting himself of his European cloak, announce to the startled class in his Viennese accent, "Gentlemen, you are worried about the Depression. You should not be. For capitalism, a depression is a good cold douche." Having been one of those startled listeners, I can testify that the great majority of us did not know that a douche was a shower. But we did grasp that this was a very strange and certainly un-Keynesian message. Schumpeter himself would have been the first to emphasize that his view of economic life was at odds with that of Keynes. The two men shared many social views, above all their admiration for cultivated bourgeois life and their belief in the general values of capitalism, and yet came out with diametrically differing views as to the future. For Keynes, as we have seen, capitalism was intrinsically threatened with the possibility of stagnation. The optimistic outlook for our grandchildren really hinged on appropriate government support. For Schumpeter, capitalism was intrinsically dynamic and growth-oriented. He saw no need for government spending as a permanent auxiliary engine, although he agreed that it might be used to alleviate social distress when a depression occurred. Yet for all his faith in the inherent buoyancy of capitalism, Schumpeter's long-term outlook was the very opposite of Keynes's. In his almost perversely teasing way, he first maintained that in the short run, capitalism would indeed trace a long climbing trajectory, adding that, in these things, a century is a short run. But then came the disconcerting final judgment. Can capitalism survive? No, I do not think it can. We shall have to learn more about this curiously contradictory man. Joseph Alois Schumpeter was born in Austria in 1883, the same year as Keynes's birth, of solid but undistinguished stock. His father died when he was 4. 7 years later, his mother married a distinguished general, and young Schumpeter was sent to the Theresianum, an exclusive school for the sons of the aristocracy. The exposure of the youngster to an entirely different stratum of society was, by general account, of decisive importance in shaping his outlook. Schumpeter soon adopted the manners and tastes of his schoolmates, acquiring aristocratic airs that clung to him all his life. He irritated his colleagues at more than one university by appearing in faculty meetings in riding habit, and he liked to maintain that he had always had 3 wishes, to be a great lover, a great horseman, and a great economist, but that, alas, life had granted him only 2 of the 3. For all the aristocratic airs, however, we shall see that in the end, Schumpeter awards the laurel of history to another group. But that is a twist of the story that will have to wait until the end of this chapter. He entered the University of Vienna, a great center of economic learning at the time, and was immediately a star student, never a beginner, in the opinion of the famous economist Arthur Spiethoff. But also immediately an enfant terrible, risking his fate by disagreeing openly with his even more famous teacher, Eugen von Böhm-Bawerk. After Vienna, there was a sojourn in England that led to a brief and unhappy marriage, and then a lucrative position as financial advisor to a princess in Egypt. There, Schumpeter performed the miracle of cutting in half the rents on the princess's estates while doubling her income, simply by taking no more for his personal income than he was legally entitled to. More important, while in Egypt, he published his first book on the nature of economic theorizing, a book that landed him a professorship in Austria, and 3 years later, at age 27, he published The Theory of Economic Development, instantly recognized as a small masterpiece. The Theory of Economic Development sounds like an analysis of what we have come to call the underdeveloped world. But in 1912, the special economic status and problems of that world had not yet come into existence. This was still the age of unabashed colonialism. Schumpeter's book was about another kind of development, the way in which capitalism develops its propensities for growth. Scholarly in tone and tedious in style, although lit from time to time with lightning flashes, the book would not strike the casual reader as being of much political importance. Yet this academic treatise was destined to become the basis for one of the most influential interpretations of capitalism ever written. The exposition begins in Schumpeter's contradictory way. It is a book about capitalist growth and dynamics, but it opens with a depiction of a capitalist economy in which growth is totally absent. Schumpeter's initial portrait describes a capitalism that lacks the very ingredient that brought growth into the worlds of Smith and Mill and Marx and Keynes, namely the accumulation of capital. Schumpeter describes instead a capitalism sans accumulation, a capitalism whose flow of production is perfectly static and changeless, reproducing itself in a circular flow that never alters or expands its creation of wealth. The model resembles the stationary state envisaged by Ricardo and Mill, with the difference that the stationary state seemed the end of capitalism to the early writers, whereas for Schumpeter, it was the setting for the beginning of capitalism. Therefore, we must examine the characteristics of the circular flow a little more carefully. Because the system has no momentum, inertia is the rule of its economic life. All knowledge and habit once acquired, writes Schumpeter, becomes as firmly rooted in ourselves as a railway embankment in the earth. Thus, having found by trial and error the economic course that is most advantageous for ourselves, we repeat it by routine. Economic life may have originally been a challenge. It becomes a habit. More important, in this changeless flow, competition will have removed all earnings that exceed the value of anyone's contribution to output. This means that competition among employers will force them to pay their workers the full value of the product they create, and that owners of land or other natural wealth will likewise receive as rents whatever value their resources contribute. So workers and landowners will get their shares in the circular flow. And capitalists? Another surprise. Capitalists will receive nothing except their wages as management. That is because any contribution to the value of output that was derived from capital goods they owned would be entirely absorbed by the value of the labor that went into making those goods, plus the value of the resources they contained. Thus, exactly as Ricardo or Mill foresaw, in a static economy, there is no place for profit. Why does Schumpeter present us with such a strange, not to say strained, image of the system? Perhaps we have already divined the purpose behind his method. The model of a static capitalism is an attempt to answer the question of where profits come from. The source of profits is a question that has been gingerly handled by most economists. Smith wavered between viewing profit as a deduction from the value created by labor and as a kind of independent return located in capital itself. If profits were a deduction, of course, the explanation implied that labor was shortchanged. And if they were a contribution of capital, one would have to explain why the profits went to the owner of the machine, not to its inventor or user. Mill suggested that profits were the reward for the abstinence of capitalists, but he did not explain why capitalists were entitled to a reward for an activity that was clearly in their own interest. Still other economists describe profits as the earnings of capital, speaking as if the shovel itself were paid for its contribution to output. Marx, of course, said that Smith was right in the first place, though he didn't know it, that profits were a deduction from the actual value created by the working man. But that was part of the labor theory of value, which everyone knew to be wrong, and therefore did not have to be reckoned with. Schumpeter now came forward with a brilliant answer to this vexing question. Profits, he said, did not arise from the exploitation of labor or from the earnings of capital. They were the result of quite another process. Profits appeared in a static economy when the circular flow failed to follow its routinized course. Now we can see why the wildly unrealistic circular flow is so brilliant a starting point. For of all the forces leading to disruptions in routine, one stands out. This is the introduction of technological or organizational innovations into the circular flow. New or cheaper ways of making things, or ways of making wholly new things. As a result of these innovations, a flow of income arises that cannot be traced either to the contribution of labor or of resource owners. A new process enables an innovating capitalist to produce the same goods as his competitors, but at a cheaper cost, exactly as a favorably located piece of land enables its owner to produce crops more cheaply than less well-situated fellow landlords. Again, exactly like the fortunate landlord, the innovating capitalist now receives a rent from the differential in his cost. But this rent is not derived from God-given advantages in location or fertility. It springs from the will and intelligence of the innovator. And it will disappear as soon as other capitalists learn the tricks of the pioneer. The new flow is not, therefore, a more or less permanent rent. It is a wholly transient profit. An innovation implies an innovator, someone who is responsible for combining the factors of production in new ways. This is obviously not a normal businessman following established routines. The person who introduces change into economic life is a representative of another class, or more accurately, another group, because innovators do not necessarily come from any social class. Schumpeter took an old word from the economic lexicon and used it to describe these revolutionists of production. He called them entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs and their innovating activity were thus the source of profit in the capitalist system. There is much more to the theory of economic development than a paean to the entrepreneur. From Schumpeter's analysis of the impact of innovations on the circular flow, there emerges not only a theory of the origin of profits, but of interest and credit, and beyond that, an explanation of the business cycle. Innovations were usually the work of pioneers, said Schumpeter, but whereas leadership is rare and difficult, followership is easy. On the heels of the innovator comes a swarm, the word is Schumpeter's, of imitators. The original improvement is thereby generalized throughout the industry, and a rash of bank borrowing and investment spending gives rise to a boom. But the very generalization of the innovation removes its differential advantage. Competition forces prices down to the new cost of production. profits disappear as routine takes over. As profits decline, so does investment. Indeed, contraction may set in as some of the swarm turns out to have made ill-timed or ill-engineered investments. We will come back to Schumpeter's explanation of the cycle, but right now it is his emphasis on the functions of the entrepreneur that interests us. Note that the entrepreneur is not himself necessarily a profit receiver, even though he is the profit generator. Profits go to the owner of the enterprise, just as rent goes to the owner of land. Even more than Ricardo's capitalist, Schumpeter's entrepreneur is squeezed out of his share of income by the very dynamics of the process that he has set in motion. Moreover, entrepreneurship is not a profession or a position that can be handed down from one generation to the next. It is a special kind of leadership, not the glamorous kind that creates generals or statesmen, but a much less socially esteemed talent for perceiving and seizing business advantage. We shall understand, therefore, Schumpeter writes, that we do not observe, in the entrepreneur's position, the emergence of all those affective traits which are the glory of all other kinds of social leadership. Add to this the precariousness of the economic position both of the individual entrepreneur and of the group, and the fact that when his economic success raises him up socially, he has no cultural tradition or attitude to fall back on, but moves about in society as an upstart, whose ways are readily laughed at. And we shall understand why this type has never been popular. Why then does the entrepreneur carry out his precarious, often thankless task? First, says Schumpeter, there is the dream and the will to found a private kingdom, usually, although not necessarily, also a dynasty. Then there is the will to conquer, the impulse to fight, to prove oneself superior to others, to succeed for the sake not of the fruits of success, but of success itself. Finally, there is the joy of creating, of getting things done, or simply of exercising one's energy and imagination. It is a strange portrait, a mixture of someone driven by the instinct of workmanship, celebrated by Veblen, and by the predatory drive he so despised. Certainly there is nothing of the desire for public esteem that motivates Smith's accumulating capitalist, and none of the complicated pressures that force Marx's magnates to expand their capital. Schumpeter's entrepreneur is closer to a romantic figure, a kind of knight-errant of the system. Not himself a bourgeois by necessity, the entrepreneur aspires to become one, and by seeking to realize his aspiration, breathes life into a society that would otherwise be as tame as the God-fearing old merchantdom in Thomas Mann's Buddenbrooks. Moreover, as we shall later see, the entrepreneur plays a role that has even larger implications than those that Schumpeter himself explicitly spelled out. But that, too, will have to await the final explication of Schumpeter's vision.
This book is continued on Disc 9.